Thanks for tuning in to Jin and Tantra. In this episode, we talk about orienting your life around an enlightening lifestyle, love as an alchemy for change, psychic phenomenon with others, Carl Jung's dreams and guidance, holding space for possibility, and relationship anarchy. Enjoy the episode.
Welcome to Jin and Tantra, spirituality with a twist. The podcast that takes Tantrism, Buddhism, Taoism, Sufism, Kabbalism, Shamanism, Chinese medicineism, and all of the other isms we've been influenced by, and blends them into a tall, crisp, cool cocktail. Your spirit has been longing for.
I want you to get together.
Now, isn't that refreshing?
I want you to get together.
Hey, Philogy and Tears, those of us who like our spirituality with a twist. So we're back to our series before. We took a time out of what we were working on last week to really talk about events in the world. So we wanted to do a special episode, you know, on that. We both thought that was really important, especially Daniel thought that was really important. So we did that. So for those people who are kind of following along, that was a little bit of something different, just triggered by the world, you know, kind of stepping in as it does. And, you know, it just felt important to have that conversation. But we're kind of going back to something that we were already kind of doing, which, if you've been following along, has been this little series about love and relationships and different ways of thinking about it. It was sort of like a big project for us and like really close to my heart. So as I say every week, thanks so much, Daniel, for going through this with me, because it's really kind of a big one for me.
Sure.
And, you know, thanks to y'all for people who've been listening and going through this together. So we've got kind of towards the end of this series. And what really struck me at the end of this is we were trying to look at, like, in a way, like taking a step back, kind of a big picture view, and saying, what does it mean to kind of design a different kind of life for yourself, which is one of our big themes in the episode anyways, or not in the episode, in the whole series, this whole podcasty world that we're in of G&T, Twisting Spirituality, where we're trying to go through and really like think about this, right? And I think for me, as I've, you know, like I'm always kind of like processing the stuff that we're talking through, you know, week by week. And so I was just thinking, yeah, it is kind of like, for me, this idea of designing sort of a maybe a more Buddhist, tantric, Taoist, Zen kind of mashup lifestyle that would reflect more sort of my values and attitudes and my meaning in the world, right? And I think I was, and my purpose in doing this has been sort of to like use Jung as sort of another, a sounding board for this in a way, right? Because he seems to have asked similar questions, maybe come up with some kind of similar conclusions. It occurred to me when we were doing this that maybe I could even write a book on this, Daniel. So I'm considering that. There's some tough things maybe about getting to the details of how that would fit. But I, you know, the idea is something like looking at how, like, on a personal level, maybe I would feel as the example in this doing that. And then Jung is kind of the famous example of someone trying to do this that we can all kind of look at and see how he did it for himself too and try to learn, right?
Sure.
And so that's kind of the concept of it, right? And it had a lot to do with how he thought about love and relationships. But, you know, we'll get into it. But I think, you know, the big thing for me also was that it's kind of an idea of, we could be honest, not everybody's going to want to live Jung's life or my life. People have their own visions for their life that matter for themselves, the things that they believe in. But I think just looking at how people kind of go their own way and try to get something that really reflects who they are is always like a good experience, a good learning experience. So that's part of what we've been trying to share too. You know, we'll all have our own values, our own things that speak, have meaning, importance, resonance for us, but just watching how everybody does it a little bit different could be something that we can all learn from with each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that seemed true to you?
I think so.
Yep. Okay, so far in the lifestyle that we were kind of talking about, in the kind of way of thinking about life that we were talking about, certainly I think the idea was, the ideas were that we're going to talk about enlightenment as a thing. Enlightenment is kind of the goal experience of this. And then, you know, because we're talking about this as not monks and nuns, but as lay people, right? That everything in your life can work towards that. Whether it's you know, your work, your love, your relationships, sexuality, your roles as family, parents, and so on can all be part of this experience, right? And I think Jung kind of worked with this too, you know, this idea of trying to build something for himself that would be sort of an enlightening lifestyle. All I can say again, you know, and I say this kind of a lot here, is I think, at least as far as my own little life, this has been like the most important thing I think I've done, to kind of set my own values, try to say, these are the things I think are important, this is what I believe in, and just try to continually work towards that. It's made all the difference for me, and I think led to whatever happiness I've had in life that really flowed out of that. And again, I feel like that's the same probably for someone like Jung, right? So we can kind of watch how he did it. So there's enlightenment, everything sort of working towards that. Also, it means that you might have to break with society on points, because society will want you to do things that might not always drive with your own values, your own, what you're trying to do, your own beliefs about things. And that certainly was true for Jung. And it's obvious that he got at points where it was even scary for him, because he realized he was going to be breaking with elements of what you might call like Judeo-Christian society, the kind of place he came from a very religious family. And he felt like he had to break in ways, right, that weren't small. Takes a little boldness with that, which got to the point of like talking about things like love and relationship. And here I do feel a kind of an empathy with what Jung was trying to do, because I think he decided that relationship and love were a kind of alchemy. And the point was that you would meet people who were important and special, and then you would develop these bonds with them that were very deep, and they would be kind of mutually transformative. And so, you know, I think this was his vision he came to in the end. Maybe not even on purpose. We'll talk about like maybe how he came to this a little bit as we go through, but that he came to this kind of way of thinking, and this led him to a kind of like maybe polyamory, you might say now, right? Kind of an early stage polyamory, looking at love and relationship in a different way, certainly than the people around him, probably in major ways, you know, which led him to have these very long-term intense relationships with multiple people, his wife, and then especially another woman that he was with for really decades named Toni Wolff. All right. So that gets us to the, like a little bit more on like these, what these relationships are like. This is kind of like the new stuff for us. And what he kind of talks about with this, and I'll be curious about what you say about this too, Daniel, is the kind of, obviously, is the kind of the mystical, synchronistic psi qualities about this. That when you meet people who are really important, these things will tend to like leap to the forefront. And Jung seems to know this. He says, you know, he recognizes that, you know, when you have a very deep connection with another person, probably synchronistic things will start to happen. And there'll be a whole sense of like something and transcendently important happening. So it's synchronicity, you know, which is Jung's idea that things in the external environment will start to match things that are happening internally. This is his idea of meaningful coincidence, right? And he does say that this has a lot to do with when powerful emotions are involved. And I think if you could boil it down to the end, probably things like love, you know? So when this happens, these synchronistic phenomena will happen. And I, you know, if you've had this experience in your life, it's kind of incredible to go through this. You know, you can meet someone and all of a sudden all of these stunning synchronistic coincidences start to happen, right? And you're like, oh, like this, that's in a certain sense, I think what Jung is trying to say is that's the universe of saying something really important is happening between you and this person. Let me throw it out to you because I did my little intro. So what do you think about that stuff, Daniel? Let me throw it back to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think just touching on the synchronistic part, I feel like people's relationships, you know, depending on however you look at it, whether it be from an exclusivistic perspective or a unique perspective, which we've gone into definitions of those previously, but, you know, one being a more one-to-one exclusive type thing, as in like, you're the only one for me, this is the only way I can experience love, and the other one being I can experience love in many relationships, you know, simultaneously. They're unique, they're not exclusive. But either way, the experience is about connection. It's about connectivity. And we can say that, you know, maybe we're trying to have a more complete experience, you know, we're trying to have other people who make us feel more full in certain ways, or not even that we feel empty, but they add to our experience. They add to our feelings, add to our minds, our hearts, our lives.
I don't like the spiritual alchemy that you have in like a Sufic thing, Sufism, or like a tantric thing, Buddhist tantric or tantric otherwise, that something happens special between these two people, right?
Yeah, and it's beyond what it is that you would have been able to, I think, perceive for yourself. You wouldn't have been able to conceive how somebody would affect you or how this touch might cause a positive emotion or negative. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
it's
yeah, yeah.
beyond what you would be aware of. And that person continues to do that. Those are the good relationships. I mean, my, you know, quote unquote good, you know, the good relationships that they're tantalizing, not just physically, but they're tantalizing for you mentally and spiritually and otherwise, providing you with, you know, support and whatnot. And ultimately what I think it's doing, and at least one level, is giving you that sense of connection with the divine, that like your energies and spiritual journey, if you will, are giving you a sense of connection because your energies together are higher, or they're greater. We won't call it higher, we'll say greater. And that gives you a sense of feeling like you are also connected with something more than just yourself, because it is with more than just yourself. It's with your partner. But then together, there it gives it even more meaning, as if like you are connecting with the divine, right?
Well, it's kind of like, yeah, oh, sorry, let me cut you off. Go ahead. Yeah, finish
no,
up. Sorry.
And then in this way, your ability, I think, to feel different states, you know, because you are becoming more sensitive, because you're more sensitive to your partner, whether it be sexually or emotionally or all, you know, physically, all of it, right? You become more sensitive to things like this, to the universe speaking to you. So synchronicities, I think, are always occurring. But when we're with, you know, good partner or new partner, or, you know, the energies are higher because of partner, we are far more in tune with seeing and experiencing the things that are already happening. And it's because of their influence on us, our influence on them, and then all ultimately our influence together.
It's weird for me because this is like kind of like one of the, I don't know, one of the crux like points of this whole thing, which would be, I think synchronicity is happening all the time, true, but I also think something does happen experientially where the universe kind of bends a little bit to say, hey, this is an important thing. And I think that was like a big thing for Jung. He kind of started to think, you know, normally when people think about things, they think about themselves and the universe in a more separate way.
Sure.
But maybe that's not really what it is at all. Maybe what's really happening is the way that we're entwined in our activities with the universe is much more enmeshed, right? And sometimes when something special is happening between two people, there'll be the like kind of a bending of the universe, and the external world won't just be this kind of neutral biological materials place or something. If you were just looking at it from like a scientific viewpoint or something, right? It's going to bend, you know, to kind of show, hey, this is an important thing that's happening, because, you know, we're more entwined. It's a powerful idea. And I think that's a big thing of how he got to this synchronicity. Mm-hmm. He started to think, wow, I'm having these really intense experiences with people. Very important things are happening. Meaningful things are happening. And the universe is like feeding back in a way that we don't normally think about it behaving. You know, there's a more of a feedback loop happening where my internal world, my emotions, my experiences, in this case, in love and relationship with important people that are very deep, is like part of this resonant pattern.
Sure.
I guess we kind of kicked it around like there's a sort of a societal level of way of thinking about things, and there's maybe more of a transcendent thing. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you think of it exactly in that way. I tend to think of it in that way, you know, and then you do tap into maybe more of that transcendent space, which I think echoing what you're saying then like brings you closer to the source, brings you closer to the divine, because you're kind of stepping out of the, you know, the tantric thing is like to be trapped in mundane appearances and mundane conceptions, mm-hmm. right? The everydayness of the world is kind of like an obstruction to be overcome, right? It's a bit of a set of blinders or something. Very Zen, very Taoist, very tantric, right? You know, very Sufic, the whole thing, everybody, you know, so you step out of that and then you have these experiences that are more transcendent or something. It could be kind of amazing, really. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Anyways, I know that's how I think about it. Anything else you got on that?
No, I
feel
mean,
similar. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think at least in a sense, like your relationship with your partner is a means for you to have a deeper relationship with yourself, mm-hmm. and a deeper relationship with sensitivity to what it is that is already in existence.
Partner or partners.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
As it is,
the people in your life who are important,
yeah.
Friends, lovers, spouses, kids,
yeah, all relationships.
The people.
I
peeps. Yeah.
I think we, you know, we have talked about like romantic relationships that has been at the crux of the last, you know, this series of episodes that we've been doing for the last couple months, really. But I think that's a good point, actually. It's relationships, period.
Yeah.
You know, and we talked about that.
We started that with my kids and stuff. We talked about like our friendship as a deep thing. We've talked about that too. We got very sentimental about it. It was one of our most tear-jerking moments where we got to like talk about how much you've changed my life, Daniel, because you really have.
But it's a good reminder for people that like it's relationships, but maybe a larger word is community. You know, in that
it can be, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it
can be.
Mm-hmm. If as soon as you leave from this part, you know, as soon as you break the idea from just a one-on-one romantic partnership, it's your friend, it's good friends, it's family, it's, you know, people who influence you. It's opened up a little bit more, and it shows the importance of having people around you, you know, who can influence you. And obviously we can't control the whole world, so you're going to have mixed interactions with people all the time. But it is to say that like relationships are extremely important. And I mean, my public service announcement is that if you have good relationships with people, or not going to say good, let's just say important relationships with people in your life, it's going to take effort to continue to have them. You know, and that whether or not, you know, somebody's a pain in the ass or easy to work with, if you find that they bring you something worthwhile in life, then you're going to have to work. You know, that's just how it goes.
That is true. I mean, I don't know if that wasn't a big community that everybody has to sit down at the one big family picnic together or something.
No.
But like, you know, you can have connections with people that are very deep.
Yeah.
All right. The other thing he gets to, and we had Dean Radin on to talk about this, just to plug a previous episode.
Yeah, of course. Plug all of them.
The psi part of this, right? The psychic phenomenon part of this, which Jung was very fascinated with too, which I think, again, grew out of his intensity of his experiences. Now, he was like working with Freud, and Freud's a very Darwinian, biological materialist person. If you look at why they broke up with each other, you know, there were internal politics and whatever else were the clashes, but a lot of it had to do with like a different way of looking at the world. And it seems like Jung was probably thought these things anyways, but as his life went on, and especially with the people that he found were important, he started to realize like, you know, I'm having like psychic phenomenon with people. My mind is in some way entwined with this other person's mind, and we're feeling things about each other. We're knowing things about each other. Like, he was a real strong believer in that.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is an intense experience. So we talked a little bit about his relationship with like Sabrina Spielrein. I think the first experience he went through like this, and they're, you know, some of the complexities of their things together. But I mean, he's very obvious, and she talks about it too. There's letters between the two of them where they seem to know each other's thoughts, right? Their thoughts will seem to parallel each other, or their ideas will seem to parallel each other. Not perfect. They think different things. They're still individuals, right? But there are ways in which their thoughts and ideas are happening. And he talks about this as kind of like a blending of their, we probably say in Chinese medicine, like their shens. In Taoist culture, their shens, but their spirits, their souls are having some kind of connection with one another that's, you know, has that, again, that transcendent paranormal quality to it. You know, he got really famous for doing paranormal stuff, but I think it grew out in part of like, wow, I'm having these psychic experiences with people. He thought that anyways, but I think it got more and more enforced to him. And then, yeah, this became a really big deal for him, right?
Right.
So I think if you've had these experiences, it's like pretty powerful. Like, you can know like, oh, wow, this person is experiencing this emotion. I can feel it now, right? Mm. Sometimes you can even feel like things in their body, right? I can feel that they're feeling something, right? Your body almost seems to mirror it. Or sometimes you just read people's minds, you know? It's crazy. Mm. But I can remember with like the first really intense relationship I had, and this is the person who kind of got me, had a big influence on me in terms of like, we were together for 7 years, probably not destined to be forever together. But, you know, we had a lot of impact on one another. And there are times when I would like, it was crazy. And I know you've had these things too, where you just read like the person's mind. You would just know. Mm-hmm. Remember, we were studying or something, just as a brief anecdote. And we were in, you know, we were in undergrad. And all of a sudden I just said to her, well, don't worry, your Aunt Linda will take care of that for the party or something. You know, some party they were having for a family member or whatever. And she looked at me and she said, I hadn't asked you that question yet. And I went, what? And I was like, I thought you did. And she goes, no, I didn't. And I was like, okay, I knew you were going to ask me that. And we had nothing to do with what we were talking about. I was working on some physics homework or psych homework, whatever I was doing. She was working on something else. And it was just one of those things where you've been sitting together with, you know, someone like that, and your mind's just go, oh, you know, and then you just give the answer. I know that shit happens between people like this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And Jung started talking about these things that he was having with people, that there were these elements of like interconnectivity that went beyond kind of what you might think of as the mundane sort of materialistic ways of thinking about things. And so I know, with others, with kids, with friends, you can have this too, obviously, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of know what's going on with them. And so I think it got into a view that fit into kind of a spiritual view too, where he started thinking, well, my mind, my consciousness, he liked to use probably the word consciousness, conscious and unconscious, is more than what people think it is. And in this way, it's a little bit beyond how people, one of your favorite things you're talking about lately, space and time.
Right.
Space and time is different for it, right? Daniel's been fascinated by this lately, you know, and his zeniness, right? It's not governed by the kind of rules that the way we think it might be.
No.
Like he got to think about this. And so in some ways, I think even that collective unconscious thing was partially an internal thing in the psyche of a person, but also like, I don't know, connected to the external environment in like unexpected ways, right? That allows you to do these kinds of things. Trippy. You got a good story of reading somebody's mind or some other thing like that?
Man, I got so many.
There's so many of them, but yeah.
Oh man, there was a friend of mine who, and I'd known her for a long time. Oh no, it was, And we were working out next to each other. This is a couple of years ago. I'm still friends with her now, and she listens to the podcast all the time. So,
okay, good.
What's up, my friend in Iowa? she knows who she is. She was doing some exercises near me, and I forgot. I don't know what she said. I couldn't hear the words, but she said something, and I looked over her and I said, "Oh, what did you say?" And she's like, "I didn't say anything." I was like, "Yeah, you did." She's like, "No, I didn't say anything." I was like, "Well, what were you just doing?" She goes, "Oh, I was thinking." I said, "Oh, well, I heard you."
I heard you. I could hear the person thinking.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah. And like, funny, like from afar too.
Yeah, we weren't even that close. I mean, we're 15 feet away, but like.
I mean, but sometimes it's like, the person's like in like a different part of the town. You're not even the same place, you know?
Yeah. That's good. It's like mother's intuition. You know, that's, I think, part of the unfortunate part about like growing up. Is that like, you know, we are placed with schedules upon us and places to go and things to do. And, you know, like kids are getting older faster, but adolescence seems to be moving closer to 30 than it.
Yeah.
You know, but adolescence actually is moving down, you know, it's getting smaller and smaller. You know, people have devices and things like this, and there's not anything wrong with technology in particular, but you know, you're training yourself to not get lost in imaginative thought and daydreaming in just
Let the device kind of take over that part of your space or something.
Mm-hmm. Anytime that you would sort of sit and stare off into space and just let your mind wander, you reach for your device. And when you feed the young one that device, you're training them to say, any free attention that you have, you should put it here and allow this thing to dictate where it is that your mind goes, as opposed to you doing that for yourself. And so it just makes it more difficult. And I think it removes some of those like intrinsic intuitive qualities that we're more prone to having when we're younger. I mean, obviously some people are a little bit more prone to having it than others. There's bloodlines, there's, you know, if it's cultural
talents.
Whatever
talents. Mm-hmm.
But I think just general...
individual karmic talents, you're being shamanistic bloodlines, I'll be there. Individual karmic talents,
there we go. Right. But I think just, you know, we could say and tendencies. Mm-hmm. Children have a little bit more of that kind of like auspiciousness to them. They're more willing to engage with that part of their mind because they haven't been told that's not true, or they haven't been conditioned yet. But when we pull them into the world sooner, those tendencies tend to go away, and it seems to be it's moving more towards black and white. Rational thinking tends to end up much at an earlier age, and you lose that. Mm-hmm. You lose the gap, you know.
I just sent somebody like the old John Lennon song called Remember, which is not one of his super famous ones. But if you want to like, you know, just kind of look it up, Spotify it, or even YouTube it up or something. And he does talk about that whole thing. Like, remember when you were small, when people seemed so tall and, you know, your mind was just different, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just had that like today. And it's interesting, you know, like you can have these experiences. Like it just happened recently with someone where I just happened to be able, like, it's where you feel like you really feel the person, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was going to text and I was going to say, wow, you know, I'm feeling something like around you, this need to reach out to you. Like I can feel it, like in my abdomen, like in my gut, you know, this really strong need to reach out. And I got the text, you know, I was, I picked up the phone to like send a message. Like, I don't know why I'm feeling this, but I feel like this need to reach out to you. You know, I feel this like right in the pit of my gut, right? I just feel that, you know, and that abdominal aspect of yourself, right? That part that thinks in its own way. And then the message had come through and it said, you know, I'm feeling kind of down and it feels like my heart is like sinking into my abdomen. Like they came like right. And I was like, I was just going to text this thing with exactly this feeling, you know, this kind of little like sinking, whatever this thing was. So I think this is what Jung's point is. I mean, I believe in this too. You know, I think both of us do, you know, this idea that, yeah, there's something happening between people that has that psi quality, that has that synchronistic quality and has, you know, shows this other dimension of how people like intermesh with one another. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are there any other examples on that before I move it along?
No, we'll go ahead and move on.
Okay. So, okay. It kind of something that you were talking about before, obviously, you know, and some of the stuff you're saying, but this is really a very deep level of human connection that we're talking about. Right. And, one way of looking at this that I thought was a little, you know, Taoist Chinese medical would be, you could think about this in this thing they call the three treasures, right? So you can talk about the Jing, the more physical aspects of the body. You can talk about the Qi, the energetic aspects of the body. And then you can talk about the Shen, the consciousness, the soul, the spirit of the person. And there's no doubt that for Jung, even though you could think about this, you know, we'll do things on Tantra and sexuality. I think it's important to do that.
Yeah.
Now that we're talking about these things, but I think in some ways he's really talking about connections that are more of the Shen, right? The spirit of the two people kind of connecting together. And I think you do see this in his, especially if we look at like what happened between him and Sabina Spielrein, the example I'm using for now, because it isn't really obvious what happened between them even physically. She talks about, like she uses the word poetry. She's a Freudian person. I think it was sex. She would probably say sex. But there's debates about this, you know? But, you know, whatever happened between them, it does seem like it's obvious transcendent of anything that's just sexual. Certainly we're talking about something that's deeper than sexual. Mm. And we talked about these examples with Rumi too in these episodes, right? Mm. Whatever Rumi felt with Shams of Tabriz, that's a spiritual connection, you know, whatever happened between them. Of course, the tradition will say, as we talked about before, nothing physically happened between them as two men. Who knows? But in any case, certainly something profound happened between them.
Sure.
And there's this terminology I thought was worthwhile throwing out here, which is just saposexual, demisexual, some of these words, right, that are kind of used now, kind of capture this, the whole demisexual thing, meaning like the idea that you want to have an emotional connection with someone. It's not so much even just about the sexual connection, it's about the emotional connection, or the emotional connection is certainly a necessary thing before anyone will feel like a sexual connection. So Jung certainly seems like he's talking from that space, right?
Mm.
And it's very weird. I was going to say this in some of these episodes, but he gets judged in these strange ways that are very odd, because it does seem like on the one hand, he's like feeling, I'll do both of these. Sorry, I should do it in a different order. The demisexual feeling. And then this saposexual thing is kind of more like the intellectual connection between two people, the connection between their minds. And there's no doubt with it seems the people who were important to his life, romantic partners, probably other people too, but certainly just talking about romantic partners, they were in deep intellectual connections, you know? And that's what drew him together. So even though there may have been, with Sabina Spielrein, hard to say, Tony Wolf is obviously a sexual relationship, but you know, it's the whole root of it really seems to be this emotional interconnection and this mental intellectual interconnection, right? As much as anything. And that's what he was searching for, more so than just like, just more so than just things from the Jing, things that having to do with sex. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but you know, that's a kind of a special thing.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna have people on from the poly world. And again, it's an interesting like sub-community. People have different values in there. I have, you know, good friends within that world. One good friend in particular who's, you know, going to come on and talk. And you know, I don't know. I think it's a lot of people exploring their sexualities, right? A lot of times they have interest in things like BDSM or, you know, kink things and so on. You know, whatever those things are for that particular person, and they find other partners and they explore themselves in that way. Is there anything wrong with that? Nope, that's awesome, right? But on the other hand, I think, you know, there's this other component of this, you know, and like different people will be driven probably by different aspects of this, you know. Mm-hmm. So some people may be more by exploring their sexuality, and maybe some people more by these factors, right?
Right.
Not that they can't be entwined, but some people like are probably looking for something different. And I think it took me a while to kind of come to these terms with this, because I think that that's sort of how I felt deep down, you know, more so than anything having to do with sexuality. I was interested in like the mental, emotional connection. That was the driver, and probably the driver at a personal level of whether where I'll feel eroticism in my life or something, right? And that's something to figure out too. Maybe it's something, if you're listening, to think about. When I kind of went in my retreats, and I had mentioned this in one of the previous episodes earlier, I had done this long Buddhist tantric mantra retreat, and I came out feeling particularly frisky. And I talked with one of our teachers, you know, one of my beloved teachers, Daniel's beloved teachers, Lama Glenn Mullen, who's like a real friend and confidant. And I kind of shared this with him, and he was like, okay, you know, it might be that you'll have people who will enter into your life, you know? And I was feeling it more in kind of like a that jing level way. But in the end, I think I realized that that wasn't really what I was seeking. What my Shen really wanted was something maybe more Rumi-like. It wanted to have this experience of intellectual connection, emotional connection. That's why I wanted as much or more so than anything that was sort of sexual.
Mm-hmm.
Different strokes for different folks. No judgment in anybody. And especially you know, with the people I know who are BDSM people and stuff like that, they're exploring their sexuality. Okay, cool. Yeah, but for me, it was like, you know, I realized this was a more deep thing for me, this part. The other part I was going to say was that Jung gets judged in these odd ways, because he certainly gets treated, as my daughter might say, as like the fuckboy of the universe in these books. But like when I read the real biographer, the one who was really serious, she went through and she really looked at his life, big biography on Jung. And I'm forgetting her last name, so I can't say it now. But maybe we can like include it later on, or people have questions about it, I'll clue people in. I should probably do a little book review of it at some point. But in any case, serious biographer looking at him, it isn't obvious that he had sex before marriage with anybody. Probably didn't, you know? So you wonder where this stuff comes from. And it isn't obvious that he developed his first relationship, you know, beyond his wife seems to have been like 7 years or 8 years into the relationship. So I don't think he was with anybody else until the age of 35. But some of these books, they kind of talk about he was in Paris and he was going to these brothels. And she was looking back at him, this, there's like no evidence of that at all. Mm. You know, there's nothing. And the other weirdest part, and I talked with a couple of, you know, other women in our field about this, just to get their reaction to it. It does seem like he was sexually abused as a teenager.
Oh.
And he seems to have been abused by a priest who was a friend of his father, something like that. But in a couple of the biographies I've looked at, and like not just one, a number of them, they say, well, by the time Jung was this age, he was probably almost 6 feet tall. So it's not obvious whether this was abuse or not. And you're like, what the fuck is that? You know, why would you, what is that supposed to be? Like, if he wanted to, he would be able to fend off the abuser?
No, I don't think they mean that. I think they mean
crazy.
I think they're making homosexual accusations.
Well, they are, but it's also like, it's a bizarre thing to do. Like, I don't remember in any of the priest abuse scandals in the United States that we were looking at like the bicep size of the victims to see whether or not they could have been fending off.
It's absurd. It's victim shaming, number
yes.
one.
Yes, unbelievable.
And it's the use of a trope, you know, to quote unquote, you know, belittle somebody, right? To kind of like tarnish their image. But like, even if he was, in that persuasion.
Yeah. But he doesn't talk about it consensual. He talks about it as abuse.
He
doesn't say it's consensual.
Right.
They're saying it's consensual.
Yeah.
Because he should have been big enough to fend the person off, you know? And just giving a shout out to one of our previous episodes, we had a very brave episode with Joni Osborne.
Yeah.
And I happened to I caught her on the phone. We were talking and friend of the show and personal friend. And I just mentioned this thing with Jung and she was like, irate, really.
Yeah.
You know, because that's what people say about, you know, well, that woman was 5'9". You know, how come she was a victim of this crime? Couldn't she have stopped it? You know, like this crap. It's unbelievable. I just bring it up, Danny, because it makes you wonder, like, what did, you know, like, obviously there's, when we talk about the conflict with the culture, right?
Sure.
Obviously, he's doing things that are pissing people off somehow.
Yeah, you know? In general.
And he's just saying things that are pissing people off. His spirituality, maybe his psychology, maybe his way of thinking about love, relationship, whatever it is, he's pissing people off and they're going after him in weird ways. Really bizarre. You know, it's like 3 or 4 of the books talk that way that I've been trying to do research on. I'm like, that's just crazy, you know? Anyways, so I mean, I asked Ryan Davenport, anthropologist on retainer for GNT, and he was like, oh yeah, you know, when you have conflicts with society, when someone starts proposing things about psi, about psychology,
yeah,
but all these things that the society doesn't like, you know, potentially it's going to go after you,
yeah,
if you become famous enough, right? So it's, you know, just being honest about that part too. But this part to me was sort of more like, I think it definitely seemed to him that it was like intellectual connection and emotional connection. And I don't know, like that was kind of meaningful for me in looking at his life, because I definitely found out that was probably the truth for me too, in terms of what I really wanted as much as anything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And then I guess we'll do our sexuality episodes coming up more with the tantric stuff. But
sure,
we've talked about this a little bit, where in some ways with tantric sexuality, you can generate a lot of internal bliss just through your meditative practice. Your relationship to sexuality changes, you know? And it's not so much like it's about just the sexual things themselves, and on just a physical level, you start looking for deeper things probably, right? Because you don't feel as much of just that kind of drive to feel like you need to have somebody to help you satisfy just a physical thing. Does that make sense what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
Yeah. It changes. All right. So, and you got anything else about like any of that kind of stuff? I mean, you agree with all of that too, I suppose. Anything you want to say about that before I move on?
No, you go ahead.
You feel good. Okay. I guess the other part of this that Jung had certainly in his life is it's really hard to predict where, how, when this is exactly going to happen. It just seems to sort of appear in your life that you meet people who are like karmically, spiritually, emotionally, intellectually important.
Right.
And you don't know how that person's going to show up.
Or when.
Exactly the roles are going to be. Yeah, when. Yeah. And you could really sort of see this, I think, in Jung's life too, as he kind of like wrestled with this. Now, sometimes this will be, you know, not in romantic partnerships and things like that, but he was wrestling with that part too, for sure. Though he seems to have like powerful connections that would flit through his life. Certainly Freud was too, you know, as a mentor. But, you know, he had these really powerful experiences of, you know, this with romantic partners too. And I think the big one here is Tony Wolf, right? Who, again, we could kind of debate aspects of how he handled things. She was a former patient. He had broken the patient, the relationship was, the therapeutic relationship was over. Like he hadn't seen her for a year and a half or 2 years or something like that. And he just started having dreams about her. And it does seem like he had like, you know, questions about, you know, ethics and what he should do with this. You know, I thought about this a lot in terms of thinking about his story. And I sort of like, I suppose you could look at it through a harsh eye or like an empathetic eye. I don't know. We can all think about that for ourselves.
Or but just the queer eye.
For the straight guy. anyways, he had these dreams about her, and he sort of felt this calling with her, and he really agonized about what to do about it. You know, he had gone through a similar experience with Sabina Spielrein as kind of like patient and then a colleague, you know, both of them being professional people. But he really agonized what to do. You know, it wasn't obvious. And he talks about eventually, you know, having this almost near drowning incident. It reminded me of like Cat Stevens. And I forget what his Muslim name became, Daniel. Do you remember it off the top of your head?
No.
Okay. Anyways, great folk singer, Peace Train. Appropriate song for the times. You don't know the song Peace Train?
No.
Shit. Okay. Well, you might want to like give it a tumble. It's folky. I don't know if you like folky things. You like folky? No, you're just like, no. Just like, nah. Daniel's just like a shake of the head, a grimace, a pained expression. Anyways, there's a song called Peace. He was saying Wild World. Ooh, baby, baby.
Yeah, I know you're going to sing it. Don't sing it. It's not going to help.
It's not going to help you?
No. That's one of the things you do. You go, you never heard it? Oh, okay. Hold on. Let me sing it for you. Blue, baby.
That's what like, people do. You know, you heard the track.
Boo, 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 boo. That, you never heard that?
That's
before?
Like no, fucking no. Dizzy Gillespie or something.
That I know.
No, yeah. I don't know.
Dizzy Gillespie, I know.
You know, Night in Tunisia. Should we sing a few bars and we'll let it go?
Let's let it roll.
Let's let it roll. Anyways, he had this near drowning incident, and he was like, "God, if I get," he's like, was sweat being swept out into the water, and he was like, "Okay, here's my thing. If I can make it back to the shore, I'm going to reach out to her. That's my resolution with this." And so ultimately, he made it back to the shore, and he did reach out to her, but you know, he kind of like had to figure out what to do. It wasn't obvious for him, right? And anyways, the Cat Stevens thing, if you haven't heard of him, you know, he went through a similar thing, Daniel, where he was like drowning in the ocean. He's a successful, like, you know, pretty big time singer, right? I know who would be a parallel to him, but like a big time folk singer, you know, and like, I think pretty good songwriter. But in any case, you know, he had this thing, and then eventually he said, well, if I make it back to the shore, I'm gonna like reframe my life and my religion and my spirituality, and can refer to Islam. Yeah. So anyways, you know, this is Jung's experience though, right? Of almost like drowning and like fighting his way back to the shore and realizing, okay, yeah, I promised the universe I would reach out to her if I made it back. That was my resolution. Mm. That's what drove me back. And so I'm going to do it. And so they did, you know, and they ended up being together like 40 years or something after that. Wow. So I think it's kind of like a deep thing for me just to think, okay, you know, I don't know. You don't know when these things are going to happen.
Right.
All I could say for myself is I think it was important to design my life to allow space for things to happen.
Sure.
That was a very important thing. And I've had this conversation really like for decades with people that I've known in various ways. Like, okay, one of the things I'm always going to make sure is I'm going to leave space. If something important happens, I'm going to recognize it and leave the space for it to happen. Yeah. Whatever that may be, you know what I mean? I'm not going to make my life so constrained that I don't leave space for what's possible. And that doesn't have to just love. That could be whatever it is. I'm going to leave that space open to make things possible.
Uh-huh. I have a patient who's, you know, going through a real rough patch for sure. Mm. And we're just plugging away. You know, I don't try and overstep my explanations of what he is or isn't experiencing, you know. And he said the other day, he goes, well, I still leave open the possibility for miracle.
Yeah.
And or instantaneous healing, if you will. And it was just kind of a profound statement, you know, from somebody who generally is very kind of flat, a little bit downtrodden, kind of, you know, trying to hold on to hope, but not so joyous in their presentation. But that he came up with that kind of came out of the blue. And I was like, okay, so this is somebody who is actively keeping, even if the darkness is in or overwhelming or whatever, there's still a dry spot in there that they're mm-hmm. saying, no, I'm sticking the hope flag right here. And I'm allowing for the possibility that something out of the ordinary, miraculous, if you want to call it, is possible. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I'm holding space that it's possible. And so I'm going to be open to that in addition to whatever other methods might come. But I think it's an important place to be in, right? To leave yourself not so closed off at every turn that like you have the answer for everything, right? I think that's the kind of like the rationalistic side of our mind to go, no, not that because of that. And no, not that because of that. And that only happened because of that. You just sort of like reason away all the things. But if you don't put reason on something, it leaves open possibility as opposed to closing it, you know?
Yeah, I'm also like a, you know, the way I always feel about this, obviously I'm like a tantric Buddhist Taoist Zen guy. And I think like a lot of this has to do with like, there are a lot of narrow rules about how you're supposed to live your life within the social framework.
Yeah.
And they can be really strict, you know, and yeah. And then if it's too strict, if it's too narrow, if it's too whatever, then there's no space for new things to appear, mm-hmm. you know, and there has to be space for new things to appear. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if we're talking about like what Jung was experiencing, that's a extreme thing of like, okay, I've fallen in love with some other person and, you know, that's deep. But, right. you know, I think like, you're also kind of bringing up the bigger picture, which I agree with, really. There has to be space to allow things to happen, right? And if life gets too rigid.
Yes.
I tend to think of this like you're like rationalistic. I buy it. You know, I also think it like has a lot to do with like rules.
Sure. Sure.
You know, like the Chuangzi Taoist thing about the rules, you know, the rules will like come to dominate you if you let them. Right.
Yes.
And you have to be open to like say, okay, you know, this is a turn. I didn't expect my life to go this way, but now I'm going to have it go this way. I was just talking with somebody about the artist Kandinsky.
Oh, yeah.
I got his book about like spirituality and art.
I actually, that's probably the only art exhibit I've ever seen.
No shit. Okay. Did you like it?
When I was in New York some years ago, we went to the famous gala, the famous art.
The Guggenheim or the Met or something like that, probably.
Yeah,
right?
Maybe it was at the Met. Yeah. And they had a Kandinsky. When we went there, that was the.
What'd you think?
Bro, I don't remember.
So made that much of an impression.
I mean, you know, you're talking, I was still, I think I was an undergrad at this point. So it was like probably mm-hmm. 2006, 2007. Mm-hmm. So it was quite some time ago, which in my world doesn't feel like that long ago. But then for people who are listening to this, that probably is like A million years. It was dinosaur. I rode a dinosaur all the way to New York on the
That was before Instagram. Like, how did anyone even live, right? Before social media. The Kandinsky thing is interesting because someone was telling me, I didn't realize this was the backstory, but you know, he was like a lawyer or something.
Mm.
And then he just saw an exhibition of impressionistic art, impressionism, French impressionists. And he was like, fuck it. This is a much better way to live.
Mm.
This spoke to him so deeply. He was like, nah, this lawyer stuff, I'm jetting in this stuff. Totally. And I'm going to become a painter. And he did.
You know? Totally off subject, but like still in this. Uh-huh. I just thought Kandinsky was a great name for like an undercover cop in an 80s movie, you know?
Oh, that could be true. Yeah.
So the whole time we were walking through it, I was just making up like, get out of here, Kandinsky. Something to say.
Kandinsky, you have to follow the rules. Kandinsky.
Where's the evidence, Kandinsky? Yeah, anyways.
I know it in my gut, sir. Kandinsky, you can't just go half-cocked.
That's right. Oh, you got to go full
off on your wild goose chases.
That's right. So that was just a perfect name for that. So why I don't remember the artwork is because I was creating my own story in my mind.
Write your own pilot for like a new TV series.
Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Kandinsky, Chicago cop.
No.
Yeah. Because it sounds like it could be from Chicago, let's be honest.
Oh, for sure. He's a Southsider. Yeah, sure. He's an Irish guy, you know.
Like, oh, he'd be Polish, right? Kandinsky.
Or Polish.
Polish-Irish, yeah. Where I'm from, it's a lot of Polish-Irish people, that's perfectly reasonable. I'm a Polish-Irish person. Who the fuck am I kidding? Irish, it just occurred to me now. Wait a minute. Hold on.
Hold on.
Me.
Hold on, that's you.
I'm a Polish-Irish guy. Must be someone like that. Oh, wait a minute. Me.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, so I think there's this whole idea, you know, and like for Jung, it obviously felt like he had to break the rules.
Yeah.
I think that felt very stressful for him. To have to do this, you know, it had to do probably his background, his family. I think he probably felt risk involved with this, but obviously he made the commitment to do this. And I think an example of like Tony Wolf, you know, he's drowning, making his way to the shore. He just decided, okay, this person's really important. And I'm just have to figure out how to get her into my life. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is like, you know, obviously like a, you know, like really deep thing. As we get to the end of all of this, I mean, I don't know, like to me this is some of the deepest stuff that we'll talk about, right? You know, it's enlightenment. You can have these spiritual connections, our deep spiritual connections with one another. Some of them may be platonic, some of them may be non-platonic, but they're right. Things that are going to be part of the alchemical fuel of our enlightenment, right?
Sure.
You know, and this is, I think, I don't know, all I can say for me is that this is the kind of things that in the people that I'm drawn to spiritually, is there's like this element they address. Maybe in different ways, but everyone like addresses this. They don't dodge this question, you know? So I don't think Jung dodges it. I think he like looks at it straight on, right? In a kind of a way that I find fascinating and, you know, certainly speaks to me in ways, right? Even though maybe we all don't do everything perfect, but, you know, I get parts of what he's doing, right? Rumi speaks to me. The Zen Master EQ speaks to me. The Buddhist tantrics speak to me. I think they just kind of get this idea, you know, that there's this specialness of connection that sometimes will appear in surprising and unexpected ways. And this is part of our fuel to enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
I guess with the time we got left, I thought the last thing to do is, which is kind of the closer of this whole deal. I thought, and we were talking about this along the way, this idea of like historical and cultural analogs as being kind of important here. You know, what happens when you see things in a cultural perspective, historical perspective. And this mattered to Jung in kind of an interesting way. Where he thought, well, I'm thinking about things in ways that aren't vibing with the culture I'm from, but are there other cultural things where, you know, this is like, this wouldn't be so controversial, or this is within the possibility of human beings or within the possibility of life. So he sort of looked at, like, it's kind of interesting. I didn't really think about this aspect of his thought process before, but part of what he was doing was he was going around and he was saying, well, okay, let me go cross-culturally, look around the world, and I'll see whether or not there are empirical analogs for my way of thinking that maybe I'll find in, you know, belief systems that aren't the ones that I inherited from my family and my culture. Maybe I'll find things coming from other places, right? And it's a very kind of interesting twist for me. I hadn't thought about his work totally that way, but that's what he was partially doing. He was saying, I'm having experiences. My mind is changing. I'm being affected in these ways. Is there other people in the world who have these experiences, you know, who maybe think about this stuff differently? And I never thought about that before. What do you think about that whole idea, Daniel?
In particular, what particular idea?
Well, I don't know. I mean, like, do you ever think about that? I guess I have thought about that. I never thought about his work that way. But this idea of like searching the world, kind of going like, okay, I'm thinking in what seems like an unorthodox way for my culture, but in this other culture, this is like totally fine. And he went around kind of looking for this purposely. I never thought about his work that way. This is a new way of me thinking about him in particular.
Yeah,
and I never put it through my mind in that way.
Yeah, I think because, you know, we've talked about this via other cultures, and I've traveled quite a bit, and maybe not gotten to like this level of specificity with how other cultures operate. But I guess maybe because I've been exposed to so many different places around the world that, and you know, how cultures are so vastly different with so many things, it doesn't surprise me that, you know, there might be vast differences. You know, for example, like I was talking to somebody the other day and I was like, you know, there are countries now that if you get caught, you know, having an adulterous type relationship, like they'll kill you now.
Homosexuality?
Right. You'll die.
They'll kill you. You'll die. Yeah.
They'll kill you. So yeah. I think because I'm aware that like that's an extreme on one end, that there might be other ones that are on the other end where they're like, okay, yeah, do whatever you like. No big deal.
I think he looked at it as like kind of like an empirical validation to say all of these things were like in the collective unconscious.
Sure.
I think that's what his idea. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. That
makes sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was like, I never thought about it that way before. We said, okay, are all these things, different things possible? You know, what's the range of what's possible in the collective unconscious? And he said, okay, people are living in different ways. That means these are possibilities within the archetypal field of the collective unconscious. Maybe that's the way I should have said that initially.
Yeah, I think that
that captures the nuance of it maybe a little bit different. Yeah. Because he looked at it being empirically validating. So anyways, I thought I would mention just a couple of things. You know, certainly, like, I think the Buddhist Tantra cultures are different, you know, and they have like a, you know, sort of a different attitude about this. We had talked about Tibet itself before, right? And Tibet itself, I remember reading Lama Glenn's book on the Dalai Lamas. And certainly the sixth Dalai Lama is sort of like a famous person for being sort of a, I don't know, very like a Don Juan figure amongst the Dalai Lamas or something at lots of different partners. But anyway, so it was in the chapter there on that. And he was saying, you know, in Tibet, though, there really wasn't really any expectation that women or men would be monogamous. It just wasn't like that. You know, I think the idea was that you'd have the family and the, you know, the family structure would probably stay stable. So kids would have a stable environment.
Right.
But the lives themselves could be non-monogamous. So it was a sort of a different flip totally. And we talked about this a lot with like Esther Perel, you know, in our episodes around her, where American culture for sure went the totally opposite direction. American culture said, we'll break the family up. And if people aren't going to be like with this one partner, we're not going to like, you know, we're going to, they went the exact opposite. And then divorce is the natural result of that. So it almost looks like it's a different kind of cultural computing going on, right? Where that culture kind of put stuff through the computer and just came up with a different solution, right? Where American culture is not like that at all. American culture is very much so like, you know, the minute it becomes something where the person doesn't want to be just with that one partner anymore, then they have to divorce, you know, or they don't want to be with, yeah, it's just divorce. And then the kids get kind of torn apart. So I'm not saying there's any right or wrong in that, to be honest, and I'm not judging anyone for going through divorces, but it's not an easy set of questions for sure.
No,
and the Tibetan culture answered it in a different way. You know, I think that's my only point on this.
Yeah, it's definitely very pervasive. You know, I think my mom, like I mentioned in episodes previous, you know, kind of changed my mind on some of that stuff. Just as an adult, you know, she was talking about something and she was like, you know, because she was married to somebody who lived in Singapore.
Oh.
And she lives in San Francisco. And she's like, you know, someone's like, well, you know, you guys are apart a lot. What would you do if you found out that like, he had this or had that? She's like, I mean, we would talk about it, of course. And if he wanted to pursue that as his primary relationship, then that's what we would do. But I mean, I can't be everywhere all the time. And if, you know, depending on what we wanted to do with our relationship, we'd have to address it at that time. But she's like, that is not the death nail for any relationship. She's like, it just isn't. She's like, people get over all kinds of things. Alcohol, drug abuse, neglect, gambling. Like she's like, are those things that much less bad than this? She's like, are we, where do we draw the line between
What's our scale of like badness really bad. And what's tolerable and not tolerable?
Yeah. For me, the answer is abuse. That's that's the line.
But I think like the point Esther Perel's making, and then like Dan Savage is another person we mentioned here and there, is that like cultures make their decisions on these things and they draw their lines.
That's correct.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned your mom, because my mom is like, I've had conversations with her about this, because it was like, it seemed pretty clear, you know, that my father probably had other partners, you know? And my mom has said things like, well, if I really had thought about it that way, I would have done the same. My mom's like 83. She's like, I don't know. What was I thinking? So now she's looking back at her life. We have great conversations now. She's like, I don't know what the hell I was thinking. Gutting it out with this guy all these years. Should have enjoyed my life more. But anyways, that's my mom. She's cute. Okay, I wanted to mention the Moso culture.
What is it?
Which is another, it's Moso, M-U-S-U-O.
Okay.
I sent our Ryan Davenport, anthropologist on retainer, to go out and like kind of get a little bit more about this for me. But I've looked into them, and I've kind of sometimes talked about them in classroom situations just to show relativity of ideas. So when I talk about Buddhist philosophy, I usually go and say, hey, cultures can be really, really different. And Buddhism points this out.
Mm-hmm.
And what is like very like real for one culture, what seems like absolute values, absolute norms, absolute ethics, absolute morality, is nothing for another culture. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that much diversity,
mm-hmm.
right? So in this culture, what's really fascinating about it, and I think, I don't know if Jung knew about this, but I'm sure he would have been fascinated by it. So they have a deep shamanic part of their culture, right? Their shamanistic culture up. They're in the Himalayas. They're probably more related. They're a tantric Buddhist culture. So probably more related to Tibet, but like within China.
Right.
And it's not a small group of people. You know, it's like 70,000 people live in this community, but it's probably like much more towards like the matriarchy end of the spectrum of things, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like radically different. So certainly it's shamanic. There's like ancestor things. There's mother goddess things. There's Tibetan Buddhist tantric aspects of things. But the way the culture works is the women kind of control all the money. I think the men have a little bit more influence on the politics, but the women control the money.
Mm.
And they live more together and take care of the kids kind of together.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the kids being taken care of more by the women, right? There's no marriages. What happens instead is each woman lives independently. Each man lives independently. If a woman chooses, the woman makes the choice of who the partner is going to be. So if she chooses that she wants a partner, that person can come and be part of her life. Some of them will be long-going, ongoing relationships. They call it like walking marriage or something.
Hmm.
But they can, you know, she can be with multiple people if she wants. The man can be with multiple people. And because it's really strange, because there's like, or interesting, because there's no concern about paternity. There's not a big deal about this because all the kids are going to be raised
right
away. It's kind of like the takes a village to make a child thing,
mm-hmm.
pushed to the maximum, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you know, they talk about these kind of nighttime visits where. You know, you can get together with a partner, but really no one necessarily knows who your partner is. It's not like, doesn't have to be a big social thing, right? So there's none of the public marriage aspect.
That was one of the
people's relationships are very private, and kids get taken care of like in a communal way.
When we did those kind of femininity episodes, maybe like 2 years ago,
or last. Yeah, Johnny was part of that.
Yeah.
Johnny Osborne. Yeah.
Mentioned that was in the book. I think the book was called If God Was a Woman, which the book itself, mm-hmm. I mean, probably needs a better editor and a different publisher or whatever. But, you know, some of the concepts in there were so different, like including that one. And the author talked about like pre-implementation of Judaism, which, as we know, precedes Christianity, that the theory is that it was a far more, like you're talking about, female dominated society, and that it was a communal raising of the children, and that people, you know, there was a group of women who kind of, you know, were sort of in charge. Men were kind of laborers dealing with resources a little bit differently, you know, and that people had different partners for a year, a season, 2 years, you know, but it wasn't exactly public knowledge.
Wasn't necessarily even monogamous either.
No.
It's interesting, like, too, because Christopher Ryan, which I think we should do a whole thing on him, right? He's the guy who wrote Sex at Dawn. And then I like his book, Civilized to Death, is really interesting.
Which one?
Civilized to Death.
Okay.
I think that'd be, and I sometimes have referenced back to that book. I think when we did some of our stuff on psychedelics and stuff, he has whole chapters on considering, okay, why are psychedelics so taboo?
Right.
You know? But, you know, his point is something like, before you have property, before you have private property, there's nothing to pass along.
Right.
Right. And so people aren't concerned about paternity in the same way. Mm. Right. Because you don't have to like give things on to your your offspring. Right. You have to pass it on to your sons or something. You don't have that concept yet. You know, he has this great quote. He says, amongst these kinds of cultures, the saying is, one of the sayings is, the best place for my leftover food is in my neighbor's stomach.
Mm.
Right? Because I can't eat it. It's going to go bad. I can't keep it. So I'll share with you. And then later on, when you have some, you'll share with me or something. And you'll build bonds with people based on this sort of community thing. But yeah, it's kind of like he makes the argument that this was like sort of before you get agriculture, property, and probably the social systems that grew out of that, and probably the religious spiritual systems that grew out of that.
Right.
You know, that you get this sort of much more different kind of vibe of how people think about these things. It's kind of amazing to think about, actually. Your inner Capricorn's probably a little bit like, huh, okay, different societal structures, right?
Well, there's even, you know, some more indigenous languages from South America that I'm aware of that when they describe things, there is no first person possessive.
Yeah.
They don't have, it's the land, not my land.
They don't even have the concept probably in the language, right?
No, they don't have I. I don't know if they have I, or maybe they have me, but like it's different. They don't have this kind of, you know, but it just goes to show you that because of the lack of specificity of something that we take for granted, that their mindset is totally different. Like I know one of my friends, actually Remy, who's been on this
podcast. Oh, yeah, Remy. Yeah.
Been on here 3 times. He was saying in, I think it's in Quechua, which is the language that they sing in Shipibo, or Shipibo native language.
Mm-hmm.
There is not like, they don't have a word for bad.
Oh, amazing.
So they have to say like non-good.
Which is a different vibe.
Right, which is different. Yeah. It means you're always tilting towards the positive.
Yeah. It could be a little bit more good.
Right.
But like bad has like bad, obviously in like Judean Christian language has a connotation, like it's pretty close to evil.
Yeah.
It's veering towards evil.
Yeah. So they don't have that, you know, but again, the language is important because it shows you the concepts in their mind. And he said, he goes, he likes to think in that native language because it changes the way he sees the world.
Well, I think it's like, you know, when I went from, you know, being raised Catholic to going into all these Zen things and all that, like, it's just a different vibe. There's no original sin.
Right.
There's no force of evil trying to like fuck you over and pull your soul down into a pit. You know, like, it's just, you don't have that. You could like screw some stuff up. You know, you might say, well, I didn't handle that. You handled that in a non-good way.
Right.
Could have been a better way.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's not like, you know. Since we're doing it, I have like Dr. Kim Tallbears or someone else I thought might be good to do an episode on. I think I'll try to invite her on. But she's interesting in this too, maybe as we get to the capper of these things, where she was a Dakota, like raised amongst the Dakota Sioux.
Mm.
And then she became an academic. She has a website that used to be called Critical Polyamory, but I think she changed it, you know, where she was blogging about her experiences and her thoughts. But, you know, coming from more like the indigenous peoples of the Americas, right? She ended up in academia. And she describes this really powerful personal thing where she eventually had married an American man, you know, and she's American too, but, you know, Dakota Sioux descendant. I don't know how she thinks about herself. I guess now she's in Canada. So she probably thinks of herself as Dakota Sioux, not as American, to be honest, you know. But, you know, she was married to this guy and she says he was a very nice guy, you know, very open-minded, very accepting, you know, like it wasn't like there was a problem with him at all, but she was like perpetually unhappy. And she couldn't like even put her finger on totally what it was. So she eventually got divorced. You know, they had the daughter and I think they separated pretty well. It wasn't like vitriolic or anything like that. Like a lot of divorces can be, a lot of them can be pretty fucking ugly. But this was even pretty good in terms of that. And she was like, well, what was it that made me unhappy? And she said that it boiled down to like what she felt. And maybe you would appreciate this from the shamanic point of view, what she felt was actually her roots. Because she felt on the one hand, it had to do with the land that she was in. That she wanted to be more in like a Dakota Sioux kind of space. And she says like how much she loves like the plains, right? Of the Dakotas, which are, you know, if you haven't been in those places, you're not from America, if you have foreign, they're kind of rough a little bit, right? They're rough landscapes. And she didn't want to live in a bay city by a little ocean with a bunch of like walruses flittering on the Embarcadero. She wanted to be with the thunderstorms and the clouds, you know? Like she loved that powerful landscape. And she was like so happy to get back to that kind of space. Mm. And it also had to just do with the fact that like this way of living, this kind of like, I mean, from her point of view, it would probably be what she calls settler sexuality, this kind of Judeo-Christian thing that was kind of put on the people of the Americas, right? Mm. Indigenous peoples were here. She didn't feel comfortable in it, didn't speak to her spirit. Mm. And so eventually she got out of it and started living in a way that I think she calls it polyamory, but in a way I think she sees it as more a reflection of what her ancestry would be going back to her Dakota Sioux peoples. So it's interesting. You got a couple more minutes? One more section?
Maybe do one more.
Got five? Okay, then we'll wrap this whole thing up and move it along. So I think the one thing I wanted to close with for this, it's almost like a couple of last things, would be like modern examples. I'm interested also in this idea of what they sometimes call relationship anarchy, which are probably words that Daniel really hates because he doesn't like the sound of the word anarchy. They don't really mean anarchy. They just mean like it's a philosophy that's worthwhile maybe doing something out in the future too, a little bit more. But it comes out of like sort of the gay communities, the queer communities of like Scandinavia. And it was the idea of like sometimes for people who are, you know, in gay communities and queer communities, they have to kind of make their own families. A lot of them have been like kind of rejected by their families. So they have to build their own family structure, their own network structure, their own sense of community. So the anarchy here isn't like, we're not going to like make connections. Everything's going to be like a free for all. It's more like we're going to rebuild things in a new way. And one of the points they make is just allowing all kinds of relationships to exist. That's the primary point, right? Mm. It doesn't have to be just like one person as like the sole person in your life, right? You can have like a kind of a sense of like a range of people who are all important, right? And maybe for some people, it's your best friend is the most important person to you. And that's the person that you want to like have as your family and the person that you would want to raise a kid with. And for another person, it's, their siblings. And for another person, maybe it's their spouse, but for another person, maybe they're poly and it's more than a couple of people. So they're saying like, it really should be flexible to allow people to design a life that more sort of fits whatever the truth is for them. Right. Mm. So I find that to be kind of a powerful idea too, as like a modern version of this. Mm-hmm. And probably Jung would be fascinated by this too. I think he finds all of this interesting.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of wrestling with these things. Right. So that's the relation anarchy thing with this. And I don't know. Not forcing things into certain forms. So I know this is going to happen with Gen Z, but I'll tell one last Gen Z tale and then we can get out of here. Because it does seem like maybe Gen Z is changing on this. I have a friend whose daughter was going to do the heroic dose of psilocybin. So you can maybe explain what that's about, Daniel.
That was put forth by Terrence McKenna and is 5 grams.
Mm-hmm.
That is the hero's dose.
Where you go through and you're really taking a good dose to really have it be transformative, right?
An intense experience. I mean, but the number is arbitrary. I mean, based on the potency of what it is that you're taking, I've seen people have transformative doses with a 0.5 gram. So,
and you've talked about that with ayahuasca too. It doesn't have to be some huge dose, right? Sometimes it's just as powerful with a small dose, right?
Yeah, without a doubt. If you're open, and sometimes you do need to be hit with a hammer. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
And you do need to have your defenses lowered. But anyways.
Well, the anecdote is that this friend of mine had someone who was coming in who was sort of did like kind of mental health work with psilocybin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the idea was they were going to do this together. And I don't know the knownness of this person, but I don't know whoever the person was, this was their area of expertise.
Yeah.
So went through the dosing thing, and apparently it wasn't that dramatic, or like nothing really too amazing happened. That's not the point of the story. Point of the story at the end is they were chatting, and this guy, the psilocybin therapist, was kind of like talking about his relationship with his now I guess to be ex-wife or something. And he was saying, well, she wanted to do this polyamory thing, and he was very derogatory towards it and very derogatory towards her even thinking about this. And what was interesting is my friend's daughter heard this, he left. And then she turned to my friend, this daughter, and said, that's so judgmental of that guy. I don't think I like that guy anymore. I think I've totally changed my opinion of him.
Hmm.
Because of his judgmentalness. And I thought, well, that's interesting, So I wonder, maybe just as a capper to this, like where this is going to go with people in the future. Because things are evolving. And I was like, oh, that's a very interesting, like Gen Z story, my friend told me. you know, and she knows how I think about things too. I mean, she knows we're doing these episodes. And she was like, huh, you know, when she told me, I was like, yeah, there's like, maybe there's evolution and Gen Z will take this in new ways that like other people wouldn't have anticipated. Mm. You know, I guess we'll see where it goes. Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, fingers crossed. I mean, in any case, I think no matter what you think, I think the main idea at the end would be like to be able to like design a life that suits your own spirit.
Right.
I think that's the goal of everything, right? Whatever that is for you, and not feel like it has to be compelled. Mm-hmm. Right. I think that's the ultimate goal. Okay. Thanks so much, Daniel, for letting me do this series. And you stayed an extra couple of minutes here too. So we can finish up. So thanks a lot, Daniel. And thanks for everyone for listening on this. This has really been a really like deep to my heart set of episodes. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the appropriate title for this, Relationship Anarchy.
Yeah. Okay. I'm into it. Yeah.
Well, Eric, as always, thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you much, Daniel.
Audience, whether you're viewing or listening or doing both, perhaps you probably would do both at some point. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for listening. Thanks for rocking with us. You know, whether this is number one or number 300 and whatever we're at right now, you know, we definitely appreciate all the love. Feel free to hit us up at jinandtantra@gmail.com. Leave a link in the YouTube if you're watching it. If you're listening it, you know, you could leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It definitely helps out the podcast. Same thing if you're, you know, whatever, however you're consuming it, like, subscribe, all that stuff. If you're on Instagram, hit us up, send us a message. We do, we read the messages and we respond, generally speaking. You know, we appreciate all the feedback. I know since our last episode, I got a bunch of feedback on the previous episode that we did. Yeah. And it was really great, good feedback, a lot of good conversation starters for me and for these kind of folks. And, you know, we do it because we love doing it.
It's a good way to think about it. A lot of conversation starters, hopefully. I haven't thought about that phrase with this, but we're trying to do conversation starters. That's true.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. And that's it. So, you know, we love it. We appreciate it, all the feedback that we get from everybody. And, you know, we hope to continue to do so. And yeah, that's it. So for Eric, this is Daniel. We'll catch you on the next one. Bye-bye. I want you to get together. I want you to get together. Put your hands together one time. I want you to get together. I want you to get together.